David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 417. I'm your host, Steve Raker, heading out for some family time tent camping in the Savage Land. But first, we've got a giant-sized, what have you been reading this summer, recent reads roundtable. Andrew the LA Rabbit and WWX Kevin will be on in a few to chew the fat and spew the facts. But first, it's a long-time tradition going back to when David was hosting the show and we were among the content providers. It's tradition for the host of the show to share a few quick recommendations before getting on to the feature content. So in this case, I guess consider them bonus recent reads. Marvel Noise is the semi-monthly podcast proudly sponsored by nobody. You can find, stream, and download episodes new and old over on marvelnoise.com and give us feedback and see cover galleries and get new episode announcements on our Facebook and X Twitter pages. Thanks as always to the podcasting kingpin of crime, Derek Howard, and his Deliberate Noise Network for supporting us and the show in really every way possible. His flagship show, Comic Book Noise, is so good it's criminal. Now, as much as I loved the original What If series from the Bronze Age back when I was a youth, over time I've felt like in recent years, maybe decade or so, that the concept has been watered down to these themed bundles of five or six one-shots and not really handled with the same relative level of talent as during the book's better days. That said, this summer's current offering of What If Dark has produced at least two issues that I thought were pretty entertaining. The first is What If Dark Loki, sporting an immediately recognizable Walt Simonson cover with Loki and Surtur and the Twilight Sword. In fact, the now deservedly esteemed Mr. Simonson writes this issue, and he spins a fun yarn. Well, fun if you're Loki or Surtur. The art is top-notch by Scott Eaton, with Scott Hanna and Cam Smith inks, and it's a what-if-y kind of story where Loki has his day and lays siege to Asgard. The story's of epic scale, as a tale like this should be. It all goes bad like a what-if should. The second issue is What If Dark Spider-Gwen. So much for that ghost spider thing, I guess. This issue features a Greg Land cover that's an homage of the classic panel of Spidey cradling Gwen's dead body and shaking his fist in the sky, but here the characters are reversed, and that's the twist of this issue. It features four pages of reprint material from that classic Amazing Spider-Man issue before deviating into its own timeline in a story written by Jerry Conway and Jordy Hauser with art by Raymond Box. It's a very different take on how a Spider-Gwen could have been, and a cool use of Harry Osborn in this ish too. But going two for two on these first installments of this wave of what-if dark books, I think I'll be checking out the rest of the pack as they're released. Cool to have some solid what-if comics again. Now hang tight and face front while I get Andrew and Kevin on the horn. What's going on, guys?
Well, since we're primarily a Thunderbolts podcast now,
is that what's happened here? I thought we were a New Warriors Nova podcast with these recent episodes.
Hey, Rich Rider is my Nova, as Jerry McDade once said.
For real. I mean, he's not wrong.
But you brought up the Thunderbolts.
Yes. Once again, the Thunderbolts will have a series.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. And out with the Zubbolts. In with the Lanzig and Kelly Thunderbolts.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I think they should do a good job. I mean, they understand how to write and portray Red Hulk and Elektra. And they really get the Thunderbolts in a way.
Now, I got some bad news for you. They're bringing back Daniel Axum.
That's good news. I read all those comics.
I kid. That's not who they're using. No one's bringing that guy back.
They're bringing back Charcoal, Kevin.
No one is also bringing back Charcoal, ever. So I'm not familiar with the artist. This is Geraldo Borges. I guess he did some work at DC primarily.
All right, we'll forgive him.
DC, yeah, so never heard of him.
We'll see.
No, DC.
But the lineup is rather reminiscent of what we have going on in the MCU.
Oh, figures.
That's my, like, I always say, I'm like, it's fine. I love it. You know, we get some good stuff. You know, mediums influence each other back. But yeah, that was my first reaction. I was just like, oh no, this better be good.
Here we go. They better figure out how to squeeze Moonstone in there.
Wait, are we, is Kevin going to tell us, or are we supposed to guess?
Well, Kevin always gives us the roster, Andrew.
Oh, that's right. Because I was going to guess Dynamo, Mentor, No Man. We're talking about the agents, the Thunder agents, right?
Johnny Quick.
Make some other guesses.
Who is the underwater guy, Andrew, from Thunder Agents? Forget.
That was the undersea agent?
Yeah, it was. It was undersea agent. Those were among my first comics ever, though, when my second cousin gave me a box of Silver Age comics. There was a bunch of Thunder Agent stuff in there, and it was like, wow. Wallywood, boom.
First comics. No, I think they were Tower Comics, Steve, not First Comics.
My first comics. It was my golden age, Andrew. So, Kevin, I hope you've come up with a... I hope I've vamped for long enough for you to come up with a snappy way to present the roster.
We have the guy with the metal arm, Bucky.
Oh. Okay.
Or Winter Soldier, whatever you want to call him. That's fresh funny. Off his latest brainwashing.
A.K.A. X-Man. Go on.
The man on the wall.
We have a white character and a black character for your White Widow and your Black Widow.
Oh. The Spot?
Cloak and Dagger?
You have your S.H.I.E.L.D. agent, your, what's her name?
Dugan?
Abigail, whatever, Brand?
Yeah, whatever her complicated four names are. It's the only one more confusing is, like, the Dathan Nayspring Ascani Sun Summers or whatever it is.
That is pretty bad.
You have Mr. Guardian.
Mr. Guardian? Like from Alpha Flight?
No. The Russian.
Oh, the guy from Stranger Things?
Yes. The guy from Stranger Things.
All right.
What's the K? What's their new name? Destroyer.
From the 40s?
Sharon Carter.
Oh, I thought you meant that character. You know, Marvel, the Golden Age Atlas character.
No, that would be awesome, but no. Someone that did their own Agents of Atlas, Shang-Chi.
Why would he be a Thunderbolt?
Because it's taking too long to get his next movie going.
Well, I'm thinking with his recent gig, he probably fits more into like an undercover team.
He could be the bankroll. He could be.
Oh, he could be that too. Yeah.
He could be like the guy with the resources and stuff. And it's like, you'll be staying at my palatial estate, you know, while we're in this exotic land.
So yeah, are there any? I never read the end of his series, so I don't know if he still has how much he still has from what he had going on.
So are there any villains on this roster?
Do you consider U.S. Agent a villain?
No. Huh. He's a cop. He's a prison warden.
Okay. That was his ghost.
Old... No ghost. I would have loved to see Ghost. But I guess Red Guardian is sort of a villain.
Hmm.
Not really. He wasn't like robbing banks and stuff. I don't know. It feels like a weird...
Like a lot of those Soviet villains, like you're like, they were villains, but they're also like Captain America in a way, like... They're like, yeah. Oh, we're just, the government told us to do this stuff. So, I mean, not like Red Skull-ish.
No.
So apparently, yeah, they're going to be going after like Dr. Doom, the Red Skull, characters like that.
Is this...
Apparently, no one is above the law. So, I mean, we'll see how successful they are in some of these. I remember when the Thunderbolts with Hawkeye tried to take down the Hulk, and they're like... Yeah, once we take down the Hulk, we'll show everyone that we're serious and we can take down anyone and no one's above. And they're like, oh no.
Yeah. Hmm. Is this... are we going to get to see Wolverine with the sleeves?
No.
That's not this one? All right.
I just like to see some... You know, it's supposed to be for like C-list, a few C-list, you know, whatever your... Beetle fixer analogs are, you know, the Ringer or whatever. Like, get some of those, the Unicorn, some of the like kind of goofier villains in a reboot situation is what I like.
And then it passed across about 20 Hollywood executives' desks. And by the time they were done, everyone was handsome and young and a star.
See, I want to. Run this Thunderbolts team across another Thunderbolts team. I mean, there's a long tradition of two teams, and I just want a few panels where the Thunderbolts are like, those are the Thunderbolts?
Yep.
I can time travel and run across like Boomerang and those guys.
No Kang. Ramatut. They're in the Wild West. Anyways, that's my big news, since we're all about the Thunderbolts.
That's pretty neat.
You have to wait till December, though.
2025?
I mean, you never know. That movie keeps getting delayed.
Andrew, what have you been reading? Got anything good?
I've got What's Old is New Again, gentlemen. I am a fool, and my money is soon parted. So when I bellied up to the comic book bar, I had to get my hands on a fresh, minty copy of Hulk 180 for the slim price of $3.99.
Oh, yes.
Wow.
I sunk down and got myself the facsimile edition of Hulk 180.
I gotta ask you this, though, Andrew.
Yeah.
Did you buy the 2019 version?
Or no, this is the one
of the facsimile.
This is the reprint of the facsimile that's right on the stands. Because I know what you're thinking. Like, $4 is a lot of money to spend. And I will give a tip of the hat to the Distinguished Competition. I prefer the paper because I got their first appearance of Poison Ivy reprint. And I did prefer their paper, but there's something about having these comics in like crisp, brand new form.
Yep.
Like, this kind of minty Hulk 180 is not anything I'm going to be buying anytime soon. And I don't even know if it exists with this kind of, you want to talk about white pages, gentlemen, these have blindingly white pages. So it's the story of the Hulk against the Wendigo. And for those unfamiliar with the format, they actually just reprint everything. So there's a beautiful double page ad for Big Jim where you have to solve a little crossword puzzle, and you could win $100 worth of Big Jim toys.
Nice.
Which I believe, given the obscurity of Big Jim toy, might be like one piece at some toy show.
I had the karate guy with the silver hands. He was awesome. He was one of Big Jim's crew.
You know, I had a Hulk 180.
Ooh, nice.
But the stamp was cut out.
Oh, no, this has... That's not just minty fresh, but complete. You can page through it without worrying. But basically, the Wendigo is this goofy... Oh, I shouldn't say that in front of Kevin. He's a very serious Canadian-based supervillain that is immensely powerful and larger than the Hulk.
I mean, so, I always dug the Wendigo. And he's always yelling, Wendigo, the whole time.
Wendigo.
Let's face it, though. His worst appearance is Hulk 180 and 181.
So, you know, this is the Len Wein, Herb Trimpe, Jack Abel era. So, big dumb Hulk with big dumb punch-ups. And that's what this devolves into, a big punch-up with the Wendigo. But more casual fans might know this for its classic final panel, which is a three-quarter, I don't know, maybe slightly bigger than that, appearance of a character known as the Wolverine, gentlemen. Now, what's always fascinating me as a kid is how traditionally among collectors, Hulk 181 is the prized first appearance of Wolverine.
Right.
Even though this is a substantial, it's a full, like it's this complete thing. Yeah. But the vagaries of comic books and all that, it makes me laugh because obviously as they've gotten more valuable, these kind of manipulations and shenanigans have increased. But it was around even, you know, in the 80s, people were selling BS stories about what's what. But I think these things are completely, they're a fun artifact of when this time existed. Yeah. They also tend to be a lot of story. I mean, if you don't like compressed comics, don't get these. You'll be really pissed off. But I also enjoy the opening of the Stan Lee soapbox. Hey, troops, how does it feel to be part of nostalgia? Oh, Stan. My whole life is driven by nostalgia. I'm surrounded by piles of paged and plastic nostalgia. So he hit the nail on that. It's about how the current age of Marvel, when this came out, you know, way back in the hoary old days,
was going to be to do with
the second golden age of Marvel.
It's going to be great. I don't have anything to do with it, but it's going to be super.
And you're going to look back on this era with fondness, which is funny because I'm reading a reprint of a book from this era. But he was calling out, you know, the Spidey Super Stories, which have had a recent interest because the integration of the characters in the mainstream. Crazy Magazine, which everybody still reads and buys.
I like
that. Steve, I know you like the Marvel Comics calendars.
Absolutely.
This one is talking about the one for 1975. And I love the Treasury editions, and this talks about the Treasury of Spider-Man. So it's funny that all those things are things we look back on with fondness. And as Kevin noted, the complete mixed bag of the Marvel value stamps, which in one way ruined pristine comics, but another way, it made it more accessible to those of us that don't feel like spending or have the ability to spend the fair market value for a complete copy. You can kind of get one, or for $3.99 plus tax, you can get a complete copy on less than desirable paper. But anyways, the story, you know, he fights the Wendigo. I don't want to spoil it for you.
I just thought
I remember when they bonk heads together. That part has to be the best, but yeah.
You know, your whole gripe of the facsimiles, and now it's in telling facsimiles from facsimiles.
Well, this one, you're not going to be, it's $3.99 on the cover, and there's the big barcode. Like, it's quickly and easily able to discern from the original, which I appreciate.
I like it.
Well, it's still the original copy. The ones I didn't like were those ones, X-23 and stuff, where you know, the barcode's a little bit different, and that's the only visual difference.
See, I bought a few of these when they first came around in the 90s, and the covers were silver.
Yeah.
And then they had the original cover smaller, and so it was almost like a Marvel Masterworks. It might have even been called like a Masterworks edition or something
probably.
Like that. And they were facsimiles, but you got like, you know, Amazing Spider-Man with the first appearance of Doc Ock and this issue of Incredible Hulk and a few other things. I picked up a few of those, but I liked that the cover dress clearly showed that it was a reprint, but at the same time, it kept the same title as the original issue and number. So like when you put it in your long box, you could put it where that issue would have been, which is kind of fun.
Yes. Yeah. No, I like, as long as it's clear, I know I went on about that X-23, but it's something. I mean, I want new readers, and that's the type of thing that can be a big, you know, making it obvious to everybody. Because there are. Now these comics are worth something, and it has encouraged some bad behavior, let's say.
And well, you're calling me out?
Stuff. Yeah, I'm calling.
I'm just kidding.
Hey, you know, you said about the calendars before. Have I said yet this year on this podcast how the 1978 Marvel calendar, the Spider-Man oriented one, you can use this year? It matches up to 2023, which is kind of cool. And every month has a different Spider-Man thing, although like the Jack Kirby one has the Fantastic Four and Spider-Man, and there's a Paul Gulacy one and John Romita, and it's a great calendar. But you can use it, which is kind of fun. I found a copy of it online. All right.
I mean, that Edge of Spider-Verse, you can't tell that one apart.
I finished up reading a series that I did not expect to enjoy. And I kind of like the concept as it came out of where it birthed. Ooh, that doesn't sound that great, but anyway, it does make sense. But this is the recent Punisher series. I read the last two issues of what ended up being a 12 issue series, and it's written by Jason Aaron with art by Jesus Ciaz. Beautiful art that looks like it's like John Cassaday-esque, but it's something a little different, which is nice. And there are some flashback sequences by Paul Azaceta in his, if I have to put him in a wheel box, it would be like kind of like in that David Aja type style. So the styles contrast hugely, so you know when they're doing the flashbacks. But this series came out of the Devil's Reign event last year. And the Punisher basically made a deal with the Hand that he would lead them and be there like Fist of Khonshu, basically, like Fist of the Hand. And then he would be able to steer the Hand and use them as a means to punish those who deserves it. He is the Punisher, right? And in return, they'd bring his slain family back. So he's like living in this remote hidden hand temple with his revived wife Maria, but they haven't had too much luck reanimating the kids, which continues to be this little thorn in the side of things and its own source of weirdness and horror. And the Punisher's been doing just what he thought he would do when he made the deal. He's been using the Hand as a weapon. He's going around and, you know, checking people off his list, people that he may have never even been able to reach before, just being a solo commando. And over time, he starts displaying these like ancient blood magic powers because he's becoming a vessel for the beast that is the underlying mystical deity behind the Hand's ninja magics and stuff.
Didn't he learn anything from Daredevil?
And his wife's been suspicious. She's locked in the temple and isn't allowed to leave, and he's leaving and doing these things, and she wants to know about the kids, and she doesn't quite remember she's actually a cool character. She's does the snooping around, and she becomes a good neutral character that throws some pretty neat story beats into these last couple of issues that I won't spoil because they're worth checking out when this stuff comes out on the Unlimited. And the Punisher's also been dealing with this creepy old, like, high priestess of the Beast. And she's all secretive and cryptic and creepy. She's like Night Thrasher's, nanny there. Remember her? She was...
Oh, right.
She was weird and, like, you couldn't tell if the artist just drew her teeth quick or if he meant to make it look like she has fangs. You know what I mean? And in issue 11, you've got Captain America, Wolverine, Moon Knight, the Black Widow, and Doctor Strange coming after him to stop him and help him and everything. And without giving it away, the series really ends the story of the Punisher. It's pretty wild. And
the last appearance of the Punisher ever. Forever, ever.
It's really weird too. It's a weird world. And remember Weird World?
Yes.
It's
isn't Chris Starr in Weird World?
It's back. And then there's also the flashback sequences that I was talking about that kind of reframe the Punisher's origin. Was Frank doing dirty work for the mob? Actually, when he was acting like he was just a regular family man, and was his marriage and family situation really as good as he idealistically remembers it? Was his family's massacre not an accident? Like, that's kind of piece I didn't really care for. I could have done without some of that, but the way that it came around with Maria, his wife, having her say in the final issues kind of made the journey worthwhile of doing some of that flashback stuff. But I found it to be a really engaging, Punisher and Supernatural. I know you're going to jump back to thinking that he's like an angel again and all that business, but this was cool. It was fun. Let's face it, Frank and Castle was fun. It didn't last forever. Yeah. And this was fun and it didn't last forever. It was good. There's all kinds of weird potential for the Punisher moving forward, too. We'll see what they end up doing with him.
I'm trying to figure something out.
I was told there would be no math.
Oh, there's plenty of math. I know the latest crazy sensation is the Spider Boy.
Is it really?
I mean, it's still going, and now he has an ongoing series.
Talk to me when it reaches issue 100.
100.
How about issue 8?
I mean, I'll talk to you before then, because I definitely want us to talk about other things before 10 years from now.
Can it outlast that Nova series that only went 7 issues?
That I think it can do. That was a weird period of time when Squirrel Girl and everything and all those books were outlasting like all the regular books. But I guess I just want to read more of the Spider-Boy to see what everyone else saw or see what the excitement was. See why maybe some people were speculating. Because we basically got nothing from that character. And they're just like, hey, I'm this new character. I guess they thought they were an old character, I guess, and they'd always been here, and everyone told them no, and then they kept on saying yes, and then they said no, and then they said yes, and I found it very annoying.
Well, I assume everyone is hoping it's the next Spider-Gwen.
You wouldn't like Kevin when he's angry.
No, I was just trying to see what everyone was like. What are they grabbing onto? Because I felt like there's a mystery, like you don't know anything about them, but everyone's like, ah, oh, they're so original and cool, and like there could be hundreds of issues about this, and I'm like, I don't know enough to make a decision. And some of it seems, it seemed like something I didn't want to see either, right? It's just like you see an Avengers story and they're like, oh, there's an original cast member that you never knew about, and you're just like, ooh, danger. But you want to see how the story is going to play out. So similar thing where it's like, oh, Spider-Man's always had a sidekick or something. I'm like, that doesn't sound great.
Well, Kevin, we all know you love the Sentry. And didn't they do that with him too? So,
I mean, that first series was legitimately great. Like, don't let anyone tell you that series wasn't good. Now, the stuff that came after, not as good.
Hey, it ties it back into the Thunderbolts, and that's what we need to do.
So, yeah, I read the origin of origin quotes. I mean, we do find out more in this Edge of Spider-Verse number 3 featuring Spider-Boy.
I have that one. I'll have to read it, I think. I've been buying the Edge of Spider-Verse title. I like it. I wonder if I have that one.
This is the only issue I picked up because there's been so many of these Edge of Spider-Verse series.
Yep.
And yeah, they're like, oh, this time you're going to see a dinosaur that's Spider-Man. And I'm like, that really doesn't do anything for me.
Oh, it's a fun story. They're just harmless little out-of-continuity anthology stories. Plus, they demonstrate a lot of cool new artists and writers and everything. It's just like Marvel presents with a vague spiderish patina over it.
But you need, if you're gonna say, oh look, there's some new artists or something, like you need to go even further. Like you need to find the Jim Mahfoods.
Oh please, they just want to hint that there could be some character that's going to get a movie in 5 years and hope that it blows out the speculators so they buy every copy.
I mean, if I see these for a dollar, sure, I'll pick them up. Well, I wasn't buying this, like, a whole nother series of all this stuff. But, I wanted to see how this Spider-Boy. And I do like how, this is Slott and Ramos, but I do like how they have that opening double-page splash where Spider-Boy's just bouncing around, but they have, like, every single place he's been to. Like, it's not just, you know, when they used to show, oh, he got, like, Cap got from here to there.
Yes.
And then at some point, like, you don't see any motion, you don't see any of the after, or you would just see a blur.
No, there's got to be 30 versions of him on this splash page.
Yes, so I'm like, all the way in the back of the image to all the way into the front, and I'm like, yes, I can totally appreciate that type of story.
And I like it that they do the classic comics shorthand for having all of the images of him in the past are like translucent, you know?
Yes.
And then the version of him in the now is in the true color. That's fun.
And then they do sort of reveal like what they look like, what age they are and everything, but I'm like, you think they would get a clue after like the first 10 people tell you, hey, we don't know who you are, that hey, maybe something is different, but I don't know if it's their age or whatever. They're just like, oh no, everything still works like normal. And I'm like, dude, it's not happening. Like, people don't know who you are. I mean, maybe that's the gag, but I mean, it wears out after a while.
That's the song, right? Where are you coming from, Spider-Man? Nobody knows who you are.
Okay, Ramos is a good choice. I pulled out my copy of it.
Me too.
I mean, for having little kids, because not everyone can draw, you know, with his extra cartoony expressive faces and rounded edges, seems like it lands itself more for this sort of little kid Spider-Man.
Yeah, and they go up against Mr. Negative's henchman crew here, who I also like. Like, they're a good addition to the modern Spider-Man Rogues Gallery.
I'm just surprised I have a copy of this. Normally, if it's some hot book, it sells out before I get to the store, so...
I know, I was kind of expecting that, too. Like, I didn't pick it up on the week it came out. So I was like, oh, it's still there. I mean, I don't know. Hold on to it, I guess.
Did you read the second story, though, Kevin? What's up with Cardiac? I mean, has he been lifting weights or what? He's like, he looks like Darkseid. Like, the arms on him. He used to be a doctor. This man can't do delicate surgery.
I mean, like Andrew says, out of continuity, out of world. I mean, can pretty much fit any of those places if you want. But yeah, I did find it hilarious that Cardiac was here. I was like, my man, Cardiac.
Sometimes you just got to get jacked, you know?
Exactly. Never get tired of seeing Cardiac. I mean, I'm sure there's somewhere out there going, oh, that Cardiac, like, sort of like Kang. They're like, oh, not the Kang again. Oh, sorry, Andrew.
I don't really think Cardiac gets enough appearances for that to happen. I mean, unless you don't like the character. But I don't think there's anyone that's like, I like Cardiac. I just wish he wasn't in every comic.
There was a time, though, Kevin, right? There was a time during that Eric Larson, David Michelinie time where Cardiac was like in every third issue.
It's true.
I wish he wasn't Marvel's version of the Joker. You know, I just wish he...
I mean, someday maybe we'll see like a miniseries or something. And like when Sony brings out that Cardiac movie, we'll get a series and I'll be like, finally, Cardiac, we can really explore who he is. But I mean, I think there's been an upswing in the amount of appearances he's had over the last decade compared to before.
If he hits you with a stick, it zaps you. Ooh.
And he's a doctor. He's so conflicted.
Oh, so those are like EKGs on his face?
Yes.
No, I get it. He should hang out at the sports arenas and things and wait for somebody's like, oh, somebody get a defibrillator.
So Spider-Boy's still appearing in the regular Salad Bagley series too. Which has been all right. I mean, I enjoy a little bit of Electro. And especially when Electro's wearing his full costume. And now they've got to the point where they don't just have the burned on mask. Like, he's in full mask. Like,
yes.
We're past the era of, like, being embarrassed or having to mention. Like, he's just in costume. Deal with it.
Yep.
And then, like, he goes to rob a place. And then he's just, like... Sort of the problem of like you get there and there's too much loot and you're like, oh man, I can't carry all this loot out of the vault. And I just find that hilarious. Like that's good stuff. But Spider-Man's experiencing a little bit of that. No one must die. No one can die. So he like supercharged his spider sense. So he's like getting like 100 emergencies a second. And he's like, I can save everyone. I'm like, this is like the Superman dilemma. Like, if he never stops, or the Flash, or someone, like, you'll just be going 24 hours a day saving people's lives. And then you'll have nothing for yourself.
You can't keep up that pace.
Yeah.
Not in New York City.
And aren't there other heroes in New York City that could be helping him out? Like, this is the most populated city with superheroes.
There should be a schedule.
Yes. You got between 9 and 10, for so sure. I can go have a sandwich. Wasn't this a Kirkman book? Something like that? Or did they ever try that out with like Heroes for Hire? Or is that a pitch for a new Heroes for Hire book?
Wednesday's crew.
I feel like they've done that in one iteration of that somehow, some way. And also the Norman shenanigans. Yeah. I mean, I haven't gotten really tired of it. I mean, I got tired of how we kind of got there. But now that we're there, I mean, I'm fine with it. I'm cool with it. They're getting some mileage out of it. It's sort of like how they got a lot of mileage out of the whole JJJ helping out Spider-Man thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, he helped them in the movie, you know, so... They had to make him a helper.
I guess.
Andrew, you got one more?
Sure. I know we were just in 1975, so why don't we dial up the clock to 1983?
Wow.
I have the first two issues of Storm, which is sent back in time. What drew me to this was those of you that read comics back in the 80s, and Nascenti is back at Marvel.
Oh, that's right.
Sid Kotian and Andrew Dollhouse are the art team helping out. This is set in around X-Men 176, which is like 83, that time period. It's a fun time period. I liked Ann Nascenti. I think of her for the Daredevil books.
Yeah.
She was involved in one of the Distinguished Competition's reboots, but I did not like it. In fact, I read the comic and I didn't even know if I understood it. And I was like, what happened? Like, so I was hoping this is much more return to form. It involves Storm. Obviously, she's just been made the leader of the X-Men. So she's gone through her Mohawk transformation. And as the new leader, there's some sort of interpolitical problems that people have with that. You know, Rogue is kind of bristling. And Kitty doesn't like her transformation. Which I remember. Oh, that's right. Kitty was always like, she never liked Nightcrawler for a long time and didn't deal with change and everything well. So she's fulfilling that role here. And she's dating Peter, of course. So they have a fun little relationship. So Rogue and Kitty are the kind of rival elements undermining her authority. And in the course of this, they have a spar with the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants and Mystique. And that's where all this fighting happens. And then as Storm goes off, she's having problems with her powers and finds this creepy tech guy who she ends up getting romantic with. I guess sort of a non-mutant Forge type, if we're going true to form on these things. And yeah, so it's that kind of X-Men high drama set in that time period. I thought by issue two they were losing me a little bit. While I like that time period, I feel like maybe we're just repeating some of the same beats and maybe you can't go home again. While I like the compressed style, like having Storm like fall in love with this dude in half an issue or whatever, does feel very old school, but maybe you can't go home again.
I mean,
but anyways, I'm probably going to keep up with this.
Wasn't it just a few issues later, if this is set after 175, that she would be meeting Forge? And falling in love with him?
Yeah.
And then losing her power? So, like, what the? Okay.
So, but it's, I don't know. I was interested in what she was doing and how, and yes, this also confirmed that whatever went on with that DC thing, Ann Nascenti's back to like writing regular comics. And not that this is blowing me away or anything, but it's a bog standard X-Men comic from the 80s. Lots of drama, except not written by Chris Claremont, which is obviously one of the other issues. But I think she's got a good feel for the voice and the characters, and it's fun. And it's also harmless. Like, there's no, they can retcon some weird thing in here, whatever, but there's no real, it's a Elseworlds tale or something. I don't know what you'd call these kind of flashbacks, but I'm having fun. If I see it, I'll pick it up. I can't imagine this thing is wired to go more than four issues or something, five maybe tops, but glad to see she's back. I hope she gets into stuff and maybe more current. Maybe my next comic I'll cover will be from the 90s, and then we can eventually get modern comics that are actually set in the current continuity.
All right, my last offering is the first issue of the new Incredible Hulk series.
I might have been too tough on that.
My pal Philip Kennedy Johnson is writing this book with art by Nick Klein, and other than Banner looking like he's Shaggy from Scooby-Doo. I don't know if I go for that look for the one of the world's greatest scientists kind of thing. But I really like the front cover and its homage kind of to the original Hulk number one. But my favorite is that there is a corner box, and the corner box has this really cool image of the Hulk's arm. And like his head is in shadows and half of his body is out of the box. And really it's just like the Hulk's tricep and forearm. It's just a really cool look. The book though, and I want to hear what you thought of it, Kevin, but you know, it's not Al Ewing's Immortal Hulk that we really, really enjoyed on this podcast. But this is, you know, you gotta, there's gotta be, you gotta start over. You gotta do something else. You gotta do something. You can't just say, all right, that was great. Now we can't do the Hulk anymore for however long. This starts a new bunch of like cryptic mystery, kind of not understanding what's going on, dealing with metaphysical things and like a cabal that of strange actors that are hunting Banner and the Hulk for reasons that they understand, but we don't yet. There's things that seem like they're connected to ancient histories, perhaps. There's definitely horrific elements that are, I mean, I there were some scary things in this book when the beasts come forth out of the human bodies. It's grotesque and horrific. I thought that like the tension and drama and stuff was good, and I'm not a big fan of Klein as far as like when he was on Thor, but he works for this book. I thought it was fine enough. You know, it's just the first issue, so we'll see how things, you know, get going as far as who these different characters are and that they introduce and how they're going to interact with each other. But I like that there at least is some callback to referencing the Green Door and the One from Below and all that stuff from Ewing's book. But what I liked the most about it was Kennedy Johnson's text piece in the back that, you know, in light of not being able to have a letters page in the first issue, I like when the writer or the editor does some kind of editorial type page. And I liked Johnson's angle of talking about the Hulk being a monster and one particular line in this about that, we're going to see the Hulk chasing after monsters. Some from Marvel lore, some from ancient folk tales, and some never before seen, and the Hulk will smash them all. I'm like, well, that sounds pretty good. And there are a couple of panels that show Moloids and the Ghost Rider and Man-Thing within the story, and I like the idea of just being in the world of the monsters and having that be the peer of the book, or like the different peers and kind of the part of Marvel that the book is going to cover. So I think there's a good possibility.
But is Goom going to show up?
Yeah, right.
Memory serves. I think Kevin thought the tiny head on the Hulk was pretty horrific in some of the panels. But
yeah, that bugged me a little bit on that one page.
Reminded me a lot of Willis Portacio's long-haired Hulk with the too small of a head in the, I guess it would have been, what, Rob Liefeld Avengers or something like that?
Yeah, I was thinking more of along the lines of maybe Gary Frank.
So the way that Klein does the musculature, especially across his pecs and shoulders, is very Gary Frank-esque. I see what you mean there.
Yeah.
But I also see some callback to like some of the vibe that I enjoyed from the Bruce Jones, Mike Diodato stuff, even.
Yeah, because
remember there were all those like xenomorphy type demon things that were all chasing after like Betty and that other girl,
yeah.
and they were all like in the woods, and it was almost like an Evil Dead thing. They're in the cabin in the woods and the demons are all knocking at the door, and I got that kind of vibe from this because it takes place out in the woods.
There was a lot of different vibes from a lot of different Hulk runs, which was good, but still something that'll hopefully be different. Like, I don't want him just fighting some monsters, because I feel like part of that was like the previous run where it's like, oh well, I gotta keep the Hulk entertained, so he's gonna fight this guy for half an issue.
Right.
I'm fine.
Then like, I don't want it to be just like trying to recapture the Al Ewing run, but it's good that there's some reference to that. The story wasn't the same as the first issue of Immortal Hulk, but I kind of felt the same, like, reading that first issue of Immortal Hulk. Like, something was going on. You don't know exactly what, and it seems like that one specifically, it seemed like it was a single issue story, but you know it became something else. So I'm feeling this story, too. I'm like, oh, this is you're setting things up, and this will become something, hopefully. That's really good too.
And we're back to darkness and shadow instead of that bright last series too.
Yeah.
Hulk's had a long history of monsters and magic, that, you know, the Defenders being his first real group other than the, Avengers, which didn't last very long.
Yeah.
So I think magic works well. I think that, you know, they can have him explore other corners. It doesn't have to be gamma related and his kind of particular entree. You know, they can have him. There's lots of different magic and creatures. I think I mentioned I always like it better than when, you know, there were some all right stories, but I don't need another the army going after the Hulk story for a while neither. So much rather lean in this direction.
Yeah, I mean, there's like 30 years of the army going after the Hulk type of thing. But yeah, I've seen some speculation about magic and supernatural, which is, and then, you know, Dracula or whatever. I'm like, yeah, monsters. But whenever I hear monsters, I always think of the Marvel monsters, because
sure,
like the classic, like Kirby Ditko stuff.
Wait, so, you don't,
I mean,
think
that's
of
just where my brain goes. But yeah, you could definitely do like other types of monsters.
You don't think of the Wendigo?
No, I don't.
But I get the idea of the Hulk being like an anomaly that is charged with energy.
Yeah.
Of an almost unending resource of that energy, right? So if you're some sort of bad dude who's dealing in metaphysical stuff, this guy's got to be a blip on your radar that it's like, man, if I could even control the strength of the Hulk as a weapon, but just harness that energy. Like, I could see that there are probably many different disciplines of magic and dark magic and stuff that the Hulk might be a useful tool to power some spell or be some, you know, fulfill some destiny or whatever, just because he's such a weird being, you know, that has, again, that's sort of tapped into this bizarre green energy from below.
Yeah, some battery. Well, I remember when he was wandering through the streets of like New York and energy was just like pouring off of him. Because that was that whole like
She-Hulk kind of moments of that too.
Type of weirdness.
Yeah.
So I think, well, also, I mean, all joking aside, I think some of the descriptions of the Wendigo in the modern horror treatment, where, you know, in some myths it's cannibalism that converts the guy. Yeah. You know, there are, you can really, I mean, I like the trimpy kind of goofy win, but you can take it in a pretty creepy direction pretty quickly, as more traditional ones have done. So yeah.
Like when that family was feeding their kids the Wendigo meat. Remember that, Kevin? Yeah. That's bad stuff.
Yeah.
Some bad juju happening there.
That's like eating Skrull meat and all that from the factory after Reed hypnotized those dudes.
Yep. Drinking the Skrull milk.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, I got to get to the elephant in the room. Andrew, I don't know actually if you've read the entire series, but I do know that Kevin and I were pretty wishy-washy on this recent volume of Amazing Spider-Man.
I would say that's accurate. I mean, I've seen a lot of people loving this volume, but yeah, it's been weird.
It's had its moments. Like,
as I'm picking up the weird Disney 100 variant, so I don't have the full experience of it all. And I'm not, just if I find them, I buy them. I've been able to buy a bunch of them at the actual Disney parks, which is kind of fun.
Yeah.
And then, you know, one at a comic store or whatever. It's made it kind of exciting. Because the first one I bought, the Captain Avengers, for, you know, Return of Captain America, I didn't realize it was a Spider-Man comic. I thought it was some silly, like, oh, what if, you know, Disney characters were in a Marvel comic or something? And then I picked it up and bought it. And I'm like, hey, wait, this is just some random Spider-Man comic. But they've been really fun. They're cute. You can see them all over online. I think they're going to go the whole year. It's like every odd numbered issue. So if you see them around, I think they're fun. But obviously, if you're not that into Disney or whatever, you're going to be like, this is dumb. But just classic covers with like the Mickey, Minnie, and Goofy and Donald and all that in the positions drawn in a more in that sort of style as well.
I don't know if that Miss Marvel number one cover I would classify as a classic, but usually a classic cover.
Oh, shots fired against. I think it's
I think that's a bit of a recency bias, including something that current.
Well, my problem is I can't remember which Captain Marvel number one this is from. We've had a few in recent memory, if I'm not mistaken.
Now, getting back to Amazing, the content at least, the, you know, Kevin, we like the writer, right? We like the artist for the most part, but there's something about where they've gone and the choices they've made. I think for me, it keeps coming back to, I really didn't like all the time that passed between volumes and the whole hidden turn of events that everyone else knows about and is pissed about and reacting to and Peter's dealing with, and we really don't know about it. And they went, you know, 25 issues with that as the status quo.
I mean, the previous volume went longer than that with their mystery, but I don't know. I also feel like the creators aren't, this isn't their firing on all cylinders. No, I would say not. Not that I like don't like Romita, but there are certain characters I don't want to see him draw. So, I mean, that gets a little weird. And then I guess it's sort of like one of those things when you've seen like the Brain Trust or whatever, you've seen what all the things looked like together, and then you pull them apart. It's almost like a Stan and Jack thing where you'd be like, well, this guy did everything or that guy. And then you have them work separately and you see, okay, what's happening here?
Yeah.
Like it's just a weird, it hasn't been the best. I mean, there's been moments, there's been for issues sure of this run where I'm like, I've really enjoyed, but I mean, so far, I mean, it's weird to say that Nick Spencer run, I think, was of a higher quality for so far with compared to this run.
So we finally, in issues 25 and 26, we finally learn about Spidey's missing months, where he burned all these bridges with his superhero brethren, and how he broke up with Mary Jane, who instead has a new beau. I mean, a family, in fact, right?
Oh, brother.
Kids and everything.
The fake husband with the not real, not her kids.
So, I mean, I'll go as far as to say that it's actually a pretty compelling, good, wild comic booky story. And
I mean, it is appropriately comic booky in that I don't think you'd ever want to do this story in a movie or anything.
Yeah. It also does the job of explaining and making sense of what we've seen since, of what the status quo is. That makes sense that that's the aftermath of all these things. But, Kevin, it's not a Spider-Man story. It's not a story for a Spider-Man title. Like, I'm thinking, what was editorial thinking? Like, it's a cool idea. It made for a good story, but in these pages and with MJ? You know, they did it with Cap. They put him in another world. And yeah, it was controversial even for him. Put him in another dimension where time moves differently and he grows and he becomes a roving commando type and picks up a kid and has to fight to protect his new family. But MJ? As like a Sarah Connor-esque post-apocalyptic commando hero living for 4 years and surviving and protecting her new adopted family. Like, I'm sorry, it's Mary Jane Watson. Like, it's a great tale, it's well told, but it's just wrong for this character and a Spider-Man book. This isn't Spider-Man fair.
Well, I thought maybe they're evolving the character and this will be her long-term thing. Like, this, from this point, like, she's that type of tough character. Yeah. For like forever. This is the beginning. I also felt like some of that stuff wasn't consistent, like not necessarily characters, but it's like you'd be like, oh, we're gonna teach these kids to read, and I'm like, there's books in this world? Like, I never got a feeling of, because it's not a weird world in quotes, not that world. But it's not weird, like world Inferno. And it's not necessarily a post-apocalyptic world. It just wasn't quite sure what was available and what was happening. And I'm like, oh, why don't we just do this? And then she has the whole jackpot thing going on. And I'm like, I'm not quite sure what's happening.
Yeah. Then, like, on the letters page, the writer has to backtrack because
Yes. They
said that she was mysteriously married, and Yes. Now they have to undo that as a gaffe and just say, oh, we shouldn't have said... Like, I guess it's easy to move things around when you never told the story in the first place in any kind of chronological way, huh? Like, how convenient... Like, I don't know. This, that... It was a really cool story.
You were supposed to think that it's her kid? I don't know. It's a weird story, let me tell you.
It was cool. It was sci-fi-y, but it was not a Spider-Man story. Anyway, but now we know, right? Now the story has been told, and the series jumps right into a four-part, I think it's going to be, 27 through 30, and 29 has hit the stands by the time we're talking about it. And this is a new Doc Ock arc, which I found pretty intriguing and compelling. Like, it's Doc Ock being a real baddie, although the over-characterization of the old octopus arms as like a needy pet is a little over the top.
I mean, I think at this point I needed some over the top, and I found it kind of funny, so...
That's the thing.
You see the cover for 29. It's like some boring, like beat up Spider-Man in some web. And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I remember when they used to, like, Ultimate Spider-Man, like every month it was like something like that. I'm like, it would have been way funnier to like have JJJ in the arms or something. But maybe they're like, oh, this book isn't that goofy, even though when you read it, it is that goofy.
Because they put that inside, right? The splash where they recreate the Amazing Fantasy cover with him swinging. I thought the same thing. Like, oh, surprised that wasn't the cover.
Yeah.
I don't know what you're talking about, Kevin. My cover for 29 has Minnie Mouse.
Is Captain America.
I like Ed McGuinness, so... This is going to be unnecessarily harsh, but sometimes he makes Otto look super jacked in a way that...
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, Yeah, he was like overweight and beefy and everything. This one, he's been hitting the gym.
He just likes the, I think all those Hulk books and everything that maybe, I just, when you were talking about JRJR and some things you don't want to see him draw, cough, cough, small children, cough, cough.
For sure.
In this case, I don't know that Ed McGuinness likes you got a beefy boy Otto here who I would not, he doesn't need them arms. He'll just rip you apart limb from limb.
Yeah, well, I mean, do you remember when Ed McGuinness started at the gang across town drawing Superman? Superman looked like he was like Megaton Man. He was so ridiculously jacked. It's like, how does he, you know, wipe his rear end after he goes to the bathroom? Like, you wouldn't be able to get your arm around your backside.
He did a good Deadpool, too.
Well, he evolved, right? He was a young, he was a kid at that time. He used to come to one of our local comic shops on the reg before he was, you know, hit it big. I think his style has evolved and he can pretty much draw anything, but his bias is towards the making them everybody jacked for sure.
That's why the Hulk makes sense.
For sure.
Yeah,
totally makes sense.
That was a natural, and especially because they decided to let's blow out and have a red Hulk and a red She-Hulk and like every type of Hulk, and that was a perfect book for him.
They even did Hulked Out Heroes, for crying out loud. All right, anything else on Amazing Spider-Man, or did we, I mean, it seems like I, at least with this past resolved, and this next storyline being interesting, I feel at least intrigued about these last five or six issues. So I guess that's a good thing, right? I'm putting my attention on it and I'm reading it and I'm enjoying it.
I mean, I wasn't intrigued by the gimmick death, but I'm like, you made it once Marvel decides to kill you off and bring you back.
Aunt May died again.
Yes, let's go with that, Steve.
There's something dumb, but I kind of liked it. I'm very pleased that they went on with issue 26. It seemed like with a new art team, they could have rolled out the Amazing Spider-Man volume whatever number one with 26. Yeah. So I'm kind of hoping we're gonna let these run a little bit longer before the Always and Eternal reboots on these things. I know it's dumb and it doesn't really matter, Andy, and it's just a number on a cover, but I would like to see for the flagship titles that aren't going anywhere, like them be able to put together these kind of long runs. And it's also, can I say, as a dumb person, it's confusing too when you're trying to catch up or follow up on something. Like I was joking about Captain Marvel. I feel like there's been so many series half the time. When someone referenced something, I'm like, wait, which one? Every 3 years, there's a new volume. I don't know what.
Yeah.
You need to be more specific for me to know what I'm talking about.
The one with the female writer named Kelly.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, those both went the same amount of issues, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Both decent books. Guess it all depends on the sales, too. And I just figured out that Andrew doesn't pay any attention to the double numbering. I assumed he would only acknowledge the double numbering.
No, are you? I can't. I barely. I'm looking for Disney characters on the cover.
He can't even, Kevin. Thing. He just can't even.
Not like this, Steve. Not like this.
So, what about having the fallen hero and everything not happen in her own book and happen in the pages of Spider-Man? Book, what's that?
Like, I see that argument. And then people are like, oh, but legitimately, this is they were in the book since the beginning. And book.
We should be clear. It's Miss Marvel who is not so much dying as getting a rebrand to launch it. And it was, not even a month between her dying and them announcing her new series. Yeah. So that's almost a record, I think, for one of these things. Normally they give it 3 months or whatever, but I guess this was more maybe an homage to the old school fake death of comics type of thing rather than a thing, but I don't know. I just felt it was really pretty cheeky. I mean, I guess it could have been worse. They could add like 12 issues of her dying and then bring her back for the 13th.
But it's done. She's in the ground.
Old woman Marvel will be the replacement for a year or two.
Oh, gosh. All right, what else you guys been reading?
Well, I did read a little bit here. I mean, there is some other fun to be had.
Kevin's about to list 37 titles he's reading. Oh, my God.
But the superstars at at least it seems like, I mean, they didn't get a long run. So it seems like Kelly and Lansing, they get a lot of work, but also they haven't had like that 50 issue run, right? So it seems like Marvel likes them, but like not that far to write the universe wide event yet, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But they do this little bit in that Thor number one annual. Speaking of renumbering, Andrew, and using annuals, and sometimes using annuals for characters that don't even have titles.
It's hard for me, because the annuals used to be more of a thing. And not to say like the old days were better, but it represented kind of either a special story or a lot of bonus content. It was just harder to get. I mean, it's more a function of the time. Now we're blessed with process pinups behind, like there's tons of that stuff more readily available. So you don't need the annual as this, hey, Reed and Sue are getting married or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm glad they've abandoned the, we're going to run a 12 part series through a bunch of annuals, because at the higher price point, it would be hard in my mind to just, it's bad enough that they have a lot of expensive number ones. If they were like, yeah, buy these 14 annuals to read the complete story this time, I think the price points don't make it. I was fine with them in the old days when it was $1.50 or whatever, but now I don't want to say, even though they're fun, we've covered them on this one, some of those multi-big annual things.
I like the days when annuals got up to like annual number 6 or annual number 7, but now because titles don't last more than a year, year and a half, 2 years before they reboot with a new number one, we're left with all these annual number ones for each of like the new titles. And it seems so silly too, because why don't they just do, I mean, it's right in the title that it's annual. Why don't they just do that it's annual 2023? Then the annuals would be their own, you know, long box, if you will, that were like you could go for annual 22, 23, and it wouldn't matter if there's a different regular title or a different volume happening or whatever. It bothers me that like Thor annual number one gets put with Thor annual number one and Thor annual number one and Thor annual number one and the last like 8 Thor annual number ones that never got to a Thor annual two, and the year isn't even clearly reflected on the cover. That bothers me as a comic guy.
They've changed their idea of what an annual is so many times now. Like, I remember they're like, oh, we're going to make annuals matter now and have stories conclude in the annual. And then it was like, oh, no, now we're doing the year thing. Now we're not. Now it's number one. Oh, now it's back to 37. And I'm like, jeez. Anyhow.
That said, I too read the Thor annual number one. This year's Thor annual number one. And I thought it was pretty entertaining. I thought the main story was pretty entertaining with the whole giant MODOK Rainbow Bridge thing and Thor having to like get his mojo back and fight MODOK. And then I thought the backup was cool, letting you know that there's the new title coming.
Yeah, it's like the Hulk one where it gives you a little prelude to coming events. But is that Ultimate Thor, or am I supposed to say that Super Steve? I mean, am I supposed to, knowing what I know about, am I supposed to think that?
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe it is.
I mean, I'm definitely looking forward to that Immortal Thor series.
Absolutely. I mean, Thor is always good, a good character to get a breath of fresh air, because you could get away from it, but you shouldn't try to get away from the thing that ties all the runs together, which is the Norse mythology stuff. And then, you know, you've got that as a basis, and then you can change up what the Earth status quo is with characters and stuff, and then you've always got the familiar Asgardian thing to return to and some of those characters, and I guess that's just part of it. He's got a great supporting cast that predates comic books themselves.
Yeah, and that immortality, you know, we saw that with Aaron and Ribic. Like, you can really play with the time span of a character in a way that makes a lot more sense than Spider-Man or Iron Man or whatever.
Don't want to see medieval Spider-Man and how he was hanging out with people back then?
I think Todd McFarlane might have a lawsuit if you can roll out medieval Spider-Man.
I also think that it was not my favorite angle to pursue all of the recent manifestations of having Mjolnir, Thor's hammer, be sort of like a cranky or petulant, you know, having like a personality. Like, it worked for me during the Jane Foster thing because she needed help. She needed a guide in some ways, and having it sort of be conscious and protecting her was a kind of a cool angle. But the way that it had Odin inside of it and then like was not responding to Thor and kind of being pissed at him and all this other, it just was, I don't know, it was getting a little bit too far. And I was happy that they had this scene in this annual, in the new series preview, where Thor kind of heals Mjolnir, and hopefully that takes care of that. We'll see.
Yeah.
Well, it's a fun, because in practicality, it always seemed like such a weird melee weapon. If you think about a short-handled warhammer, it's kind of a, I think that lends itself when they want to be creative. Obviously, the throwing it, lightning, and all that's pretty regular, but there aren't too many, like, one-handed short warhammers.
Well, that's why it's its own myth. It's its own... That's because it's a mythological weapon.
Yeah, Loki became a fly and stung the dwarf, and that's why it has a short handle and all that. I dig that. But I don't know. I just feel like that lends itself to fun opportunities in a visual setting that I've liked. And I notice, because Thor is inherently a public domain character, I've noticed that other companies and their treatment of it can play that up and have a lot of fun with it. And I like when Marvel decides to have, I mean, it's still a powerful totem, but lean into the weirdness.
Lean into the weirdness. That's a good rule for today's youth. The regular Thor series, I read the last couple of issues of, and the writers changed up, and they had the guy who was writing the one-shots write the rest of the series, and he's a fine enough writer, Groenbeck. But the series, after the writing changed, it really seems like they tried to accelerate towards whatever the series was building towards, the whole vision that the Thor was afraid of Thanos and everything. And by getting there kind of too fast and not by the guy whose idea it was, it kind of ended in a whimper. I'm ready for a new Thor.
That's always rough when you get handed off. Well, you just got to finish someone's story. Like you don't want to damage your own reputation, and you want to kind of do your own thing as well.
It'll be great. The Thor's in it. Dr. Doom's in it. Thanos is in it. But it's like, it's not the, you know, you think when they say there's like a prophecy and everything, and it's going to be like, there should have been some landing for them to stick here. And there just seemed like it just piddled away at the end. Anyway, time for Immortal Thor. Can't wait.
Well, I don't like being resident frosty old man, but that's what I've been cast into. So I've heard this has caused some backlash, and I get it. I still went and bought it, but for the slim $947, you too can own Ultimate Invasion number one.
We're going to reboot you, Andrew. Yeah. We're going to replace you with Ultimate Rabbit.
The Ultimate Invasion, Jonathan Hickman, Brian Hitch, Andrew Curry, Alex Sinclair, big. Now, this was ideal for me because I enjoy Hickman. Hitch has the long-standing work with the Ultimate, and Andy doesn't care about the Ultimate. I don't dislike it or anything. I just have zero connection.
You and me
both. Which was, I guess, a problem for Marvel when they killed everybody in it or whatever. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, but that's fine. Like, knock yourself out. I'm still holding out for Counter-Earth. You know, that's where it's at. But this is our, you know, evil buckethead Reed Richards, which I like the idea of the evil Reed Richards because it seems smart to have a very smart master planner bad guy, especially with a guy like Hickman who's going to lay a lot of crazy seeds in there. But I never liked the character design. So I feel like, I don't know if Hitch is the guy that designed it, but I feel like their hands are kind of torn, and I would have loved to have seen I'm doing it all different this time, boys. Instead of the weird, because part of it is also, it feels similar to kind of the Professor X thing, like the bodysuit with the goofy helmet. In fact, yep. There is a Professor X in here. So you always have to be like, wait, which weird guy in a black bodysuit with a metal
who's smart
weird helmet on is this one? And I also feel it's not, Ultimate Universe is dead, man. You can get away from their attempts to ground it in more realistic designs and the body armor and that kind of stuff. Go back to goofy comic book stuff.
Like, that's not Ultimate, though. It's guys in trench coats and guys with no color.
So he ends up
for Nick Fury.
Exactly.
Whoa.
Evil Reed Richards, and like I said, lends to Hickman with this planning eight steps ahead, breaks out, and has the one funny bit where he goes to Miles Morales and says, hey, do you want to, you know, join, we're the last two of a dead universe. And Miles is like, I'm good, man. I'm Spider-Man.
Why would he want to go?
Yeah, I got two hit movies, a new video game adaptation. Like,
he's like, I'm doing good.
I'm the only thing making Sony money right now.
Yeah, so, you know how long it took me to get here and get established in the regular 616?
So then he tells our Reed Richards, like, you big dummy, like, you're never going to get me. I'm off and, you know, going to use my fancy super high tech that's so high tech it's like magic to go to another dimension. You'll never find me there. Evenly matched mortal enemies, and Reed seems to have a weak spot, blind spot, I guess, because he really feels guilty for whatever the Maker does. And that's the Maker, like, holy crap, is he a 3D printer? Can we just reboot? Like, it's a fun character, just give it the bells and whistles. And then to justify the $900 price point, they throw a few pages, like four or five of next issue pages in it. And then they throw the pencils in it. And well, I like process stuff. And this is going to be the weirdest thing ever. For me, a guy whose pencils are so tight, like Brian Hitch, it's gotta be great for Andrew Curry. Like,
right.
Or maybe it's boring. Cause you're like, he leaves not a ton. I mean, it's fun to look at for a page or two, but I would much rather have kind of looser pencils to see, oh, what is Curry? Not that Curry doesn't have to make 1,000 decisions about line weight and this, that, and the third thing. And he's still the inker on the project and very important and equal member of the team. And Andy's not dissing the inker. I just feel like with the guy with some looser pencils, it's a more fun for a dummy like me to sort of see, oh, I can easier see what the inker's doing. But it's a weird thing. Like, Brian Hitch pencil works too much. He puts all the pencils on. I mean, it's, I would say there's more interest in what Sinclair does with the colors. Because as you know, now they can leave a lot of stuff open in the background, and it's less the anchor and more the colorist in some ways, I feel like, that's adding a ton of crap to the book. Crap in a positive way. Not bad, but just, you know, oh, that's now the colorist's job sort of thing. Well, those of us familiar with 70s and 80s, that's where the pink blank background goes. But yeah, Ultimate Invasion, I'm on board. I really hope they drop the price point, or I hope people don't buy it. Like,
I didn't buy it.
Like, that's, this is not a good thing. Like, jacking the price up for adding this kind of process stuff in the back, I think, is a poor trend. I mean, they already got like 900 variant covers. How often do they need to stick it to people?
I mean, I looked at that. I buy a ton of stuff already, so it's not like a boycott of this book is gonna make a difference. But I looked at this book, I looked at other books, I looked back at this book, and I'm like, I bet you they stick a bunch of non-story stuff in here, and then they're still gonna jack me for that extra money. And I'm like, no, I think I can just skip this one.
I think you're right. Plus, everybody in the world now knows when you have 700 variant covers, you wait a few months, the stores that had to buy 6,000 extra copies to get that 1 in 500 or 1 in 1,000 variant have to unload those copies at a fire sale. So you'll pick this up in a dollar bin somewhere. Oh, I see a lot. If there's one of those ones where there's a really hot, like 1 in 500, 1 in 1,000 variant, stores will buy the extra issues just to be able to flog that one. I can't tell you, like Free Comic Book Day, a lot of times you get all these number one issues that aren't free comic books, but that the ones that have been sitting in the store's inventory because they had to order a bunch of extra books and they can't flog them all.
Like, I know what happens, and some people are like, oh, I just wanted the ratio variant, and you can just give out, like, they're giving them away. Basically, someone had to, like, bought those issues, and they're just like, yeah, you can just give those away for free to your customers or whatever. I mean, that's cool.
Yeah, and it's, I understand the variant thing, and if there are customers that that's what they want and they're happy paying that price, hey, it helps the store, it helps everybody. I'm all on board. I just, like everyone talking about it, how sustainable, if those guys are willing to pay $500, $800 an issue, or hey, keep going forever. But I don't know, that's not a world I have any understanding of, so
I don't know. I just people try to say it's the same world as it was before, and I'm like, I don't think it is.
Well, even that Spider-Man series you were always talking about, it's not just the Disney. Like, every issue has, what, 5-6 covers to it?
I guess.
Crazy. Yeah, look at it up. If you're curious, your store may not, because of the various dumb breakdown. You know how they have, oh, you need this, that, and the third thing to qualify for the different ones. I certainly get that stores that don't want to do that. I'm always fascinated. I'm guessing it's probably a small proportion of them. But yeah, it's odd that, like, take issue 14. I don't know. Maybe it's an important thing in it. But it has variants up to F, G, H. And then all the Illuminati and Mayhew and Syndicate.
I'm thinking a smaller store, depending upon the qualifications, it might be easier for them to make these super rare. Because if the thing is like double your orders and your store orders 1,000 copies, it's not going to be easy for them to hit 2,000 copies. But if your store ordered like one copy, then they could qualify for their rare thing, because they're like, oh, we only have to order one more copy.
Yeah. And some of these we've talked about before are just, oh, it's the black and white version of this or whatever. And I don't know the ratios. I was just, when I was looking at the Spider-Man series, I was surprised. I don't think there's any issue that doesn't have at least 4 variant covers to it. Wow. In that first 30 issues.
Well, maybe they're not in the previous catalog, because I might see 1 or 2, but I don't know. They're probably just not all shown. So I don't, it's one of those things where people will complain about them, like a specific reason. And I'm like, I don't think most people see these anyways, so it has like zero effect on them.
I'm buying
them. Yeah, I agree. I just use my comic shop a lot.
Yeah.
I haven't bought from them in a while, but I feel they're pretty solid for figuring out things like released. Like, did this really come out? Well, if they have copies of it, it came. As opposed to sometimes the publishers are like, oh yeah, that came out. And you're like, well, it didn't come out anywhere I can find it type of thing.
So. I'm buying extra copies of the regular cover because with all these variants, then there's less of the regular covers out there, right? Oh, see? Oh. Getting ahead of the curve. I want the book that looks like the book is supposed to look like, not some thing like that. That's not what the book looks like.
Yeah. Unless it's the first appearance of a character that isn't on the main cover and is only on the variant cover, then they'll be like, the variant cover is the first appearance of a character.
Oh, and I've picked up variants here or there. I mean, I've even paid upwards of $1 or $2 extra for it. You know?
If Wolverine 181 is Wolverine's first appearance, then some variant cover ain't the first appearance of this other character.
That's because it was an ad in previews that was the first appearance.
Oh, yeah, yes. Right?
Yeah, the previews catalog is the real first appearance.
John Romita's sketchbook was the first appearance of Wolverine.
I have the original artwork that he drew on another issue, and he was working out the design on the back of the artwork, so this is the real, real first appearance.
Of course it is.
Yeah.
I caught up on the X-books recently.
Which ones are you reading still, Steve?
I tried chunking them.
Okay.
Because...
That sounds almost like you're putting them in a wood chipper, Steve.
Well, because
that's pulping. Sorry, my confusion.
I was feeling like there was no identity to any of the titles, really, as I was just reading them as they were coming out. Like, you know, other than this guy writes this book or that guy writes that book, the characters were all crossing over. There wasn't like a team. This is the story of these ones. This is the story of these guys.
And I find the core ones are often specific.
Yeah, well,
like I know a Gillen book, X-Men Reds, and a totally different place usually.
Yeah, I'm feeling like X-Men and Immortal X-Men are the main books. And then X-Men Red, which is Mars-centric.
Yeah.
And Wolverine and X-Force are kind of like the next tier of books. And then I really consider everything else pretty tertiary as far as what's telling the story of what's going on with the X-Men and moving them forward and where you're going to see, you know, Cyclops pop up or the Inner Circle or that kind of stuff. So I read Immortal X-Men 11 through 13, which is Kieran Gillen with Lucas Wernick art. And these are the books are really weird these days. Mr. Sinister's Victorian era wife is like this super ninja being, Mother Righteous. And the council is all falling apart, and you can't trust anybody because Sinister might have gotten involved in like the rebirth cycle. So then everybody's off the council, but Storm you can trust. But she's now like a Martian first, so Storm appoints Cyclops to be her, or not Cyclops, Colossus to be her proxy.
Oi.
And him, you usually can trust, right, Kevin? But not now.
Yeah.
He's been compromised. So the council will fall just like, you know, George Lucas's Federation fell before the Empire. And Krakoa eats Doug to protect him. Which was a weird scene. Then Wolverine 33 to 34 is written by Benjamin Percy with art by Juan Jose Rip, which is kind of fun to see his line work again. And Wolverine has really become Hank Pym's book now. It's like the Book of the Beast. He's like
the Dark Beast.
Yeah, but it's not the Dark Beast, right? It's our Beast. But anyway, it's like, can Logan stop him? And it makes it tied into Wolverine specifically because the Beast has an army of Wolverine clones that he uses. And he's got this cool, like, Krakoan Kaiju headquarters. Then X-Force 40 to 42 is also written by Benjamin Percy, with art by Robert Gill and Paul Davidson. And these guys are also fighting manifestations of the Beast. So it seems like Benjamin Percy's kind of dealing with the Beast stuff. And they come across a Beast in the future that has merged with the Nimrod Sentinel. So he's a real tough cookie. And particularly funny about these recent X-Force books is Quentin Quire is gone. And he returns in these books as like old man Quire. But he's like a scraggly old, like he's very entertaining and like a comic foil, like because he's like nodding off at times and stuff, and it's pretty funny.
You know, I got my Quentin Quire Marvel Legends figure finally.
Oh, neat.
Yeah. And it's the costume from that series. Like, they didn't go with like the riot at Xavier's, but maybe they didn't want to do him just in regular clothes type of thing, like with a Magneto is Right t-shirt or something.
Yeah, right. Then X-Men Red 11 and 12, written by Al Ewing with art by Stefano Caselli, has Storm ditching Xavier and returning to Mars and dealing with Araco, which they call Mars stuff. There's just too many characters. There's this guy and that guy and Warlord this.
I like
and it's
those
like
characters. I wouldn't be able to tell you their names.
Yeah.
But I do like the characters in that book. Yeah. And the other thing that's neat is that Nova is a regular in that book still, like he should be.
There's a scene with like Nova hanging out in a hot tub with nothing but his nothing but his helmet on. Just kind of funny. But yeah, there's the blue guy who's like Conan. There's the, you know, there's this guy, there's that guy, but it's like it's a lot when there's already a lot in the X books.
That's for sure.
Then lastly, the adjectiveless X-Men title, 22 to 24, is written by Jerry Dugan with art by Joshua Cassara. This continues the Mr. Sinister as Dr. Stasis and MODOK and Nimrod and Red AIM? They look like AIM agents that are red. Is that what they are?
But Red AIM. Well, I mean, I think AIM's part of the, like, they showed the diagram for who was part of the Orcus group. And I think, yeah, AIM was part of that thing. But talk about anti-mutant hysteria in this book.
Yeah, they're making Sentinels, so that always plays up on the whole anti-mutant hysteria, right? They have one, a big one. In a public display of heroism before those pesky mutants show up.
And then their whole disinformation campaign.
The other Sentinels they have are made from adamantium skeletons that have been left behind when Wolverine dies and gets reborn.
That is so insane.
I didn't know that they've, like, reborn. Like, I thought the adamantium was rare, and I didn't realize that he gets new adamantium every time he's reborn.
They should really pick up that adamantium and bring it back. But like we've seen, like things break down and they can't retrieve like every body, or they think they got the body when they don't.
Cyclops realizing how many Wolverine skeletons that have been unretrieved that are out there made for a pretty good scene. He's like,
Seems like they should just get him to volunteer to die like a million times and they can build a spaceship out of adamantium.
So this book is, they're moving towards yet another Hellfire Gala that I feel like, didn't we just leave the Hellfire Gala? If they're going to do these Hellfire Galas every year in real time, but still have the comics not be real time, it makes it like, it seems like there's one every two or three adventures and then another Hellfire Gala. But they're fun, so that's cool.
Yeah.
I feel like the X-Books are really gotten into all the problems they had before Hickman took over and gave them a new direction and stuff. They're so, the family tree is so spread out, and there's so many characters between all the Mars characters and all the other dimensional characters and other world characters, and it's just like, this is so much again.
I mean, I feel like you could do some different stuff with, like, the Mars and all that, but I don't think the market will support, like, weird, completely new, like, just Iraqo lineup books type of thing.
Yep.
So, I mean, to some extent, you have to... I mean, I guess that's the problem with, like, mainstream superhero comics, but I don't know, as an indie book, that's super palatable either. So I mean, maybe I'm just into certain characters or things. Like, I mean, I don't know if Hickman, like, it seemed like he was like, oh, we got away from the thing, but I don't think we ever really got away from the thing. But whenever they bring up the Sentinels, are like, oh, the humans are fighting back, so I'm like, I guess the showing humans doing the thing to the humans, you know, that they do to everyone else. I mean, I guess that didn't really work out either. Like, I mean, I would like to see some other stuff with the timelines. And I mean, we got some of that, but I mean, like, I guess it's not going to work out and all that. But we've seen some craziness. So
with all the Mr. Sinister stuff, there's even that is so much to track, right? I mean,
I know that is. That is definitely more interesting. I want to see where that definitely goes.
Like, all this is going to come crashing down the status quo because there's a series of one-shots called Before the Fall, right? And so it seems like there's stuff happening with Apocalypse where, like, Apocalypse's wife is more of a badass than Apocalypse is. She's a backstabber and a front stabber too.
Yeah. And the only thing is, like, you would have to have, like, some superstar writer come on if you're not moving forward. It'd be like, Alan Moore is writing the X-Men, and they're back in the mansion. Like, that's pretty much what you would have to do, because, I mean,
yeah,
I don't want us to return to some other era.
It'll be interesting to see what of this era lasts into the subsequent ones. Not that I'm wishing this era away, but it'll be interesting to see what characters stick, like this Mother Righteous wife of Sinister, who, you know, or this wife of Apocalypse. Maybe the wives will start their own supergroup. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess I had misunderstood or never saw, like, Mother Righteous. I thought that was from the Sins of Sinister for some reason. But then I was digging around in some back issues, and there was, like, a character design on the first issue of another series. And I'm like, oh, that's that character. And then I'm like, wait, if they're doing a character design on a first issue, that's usually when they first appear. And sure enough, they had appeared months before. So maybe I had credited Sins of Sinister with that first appearance. I'm like, oh, this is so great. They came up with this thing. And it's like, no, it already has existed. It was an X book I wasn't reading.
Hmm.
I mean, sometimes they do tell you this will change everything. And then you don't believe them. And it's like the one time you don't believe them is the one time they actually did do something. So, I mean, yeah, there is a lot of books, but I mean, I still feel like there's a lot to unravel, a lot to do, a lot to see. A lot of culture to explore.
It could be its own comic company, these X books. I mean, you could be reading no other Marvel books and be reading all of these and still have plenty of comics to read and plenty of lore to get into. It really is a lot. But it's going somewhere. So I'm curious.
I just hope it's going somewhere good. I mean, they're keeping you afraid, but I think that's their job. As long as we get somewhere good.
All right, Kevin, hit us with one more.
All right. I don't know if you read this, Super Steve, but I know you've been on the Alien books, and I've just been collecting number ones, apparently. Because apparently, I like trying out Alien books, but I don't like continuing reading them. I just want to check in and go, what's going on now?
I'll
watch the first 20 minutes of an episode, and I'll go, oh, that's cool, and then I'll go do something else.
I haven't, I've picked up the new series, but I haven't read them yet. I was waiting for the first arc to end.
So I believe this is the first one I picked up that it says 20th Century Studios on it. It has a different cover design than the regular Marvel stuff. And even the paper stock is different. I don't know if it's like that with all the things, but I feel like there's a slight difference. Maybe that's just what was available, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, this is the Declan Shelby one. That's why I thought, I'm like, oh, he's going to write something. I'm like, I want to check that out, see what's happening. You know what I mean?
For sure.
So this is also drawn by Andrea Roccardo, who I'm not really that familiar with, but seems like standard alien type of art type of thing. I did get the, I love that when, and it makes sense, I would be alien where I would get that feeling of the Metroid music came to me and I'm like, oh, I like that. Where'd that come from? I mean, not much alien, like you get to see the aliens, like they get drawn, but not in a sense of, there's like a lot of action first issue. It's like setting up for some potential mayhem.
As a first issue should do.
Yeah. So they're like on this frozen planet. And of course, you know, all of these things are up frozen. And it's like a ticking time clock. Is, ah, someone finds a specimen. They bring it to the lab. And then you're waiting for like the lockdown or some procedure or something to break down and then stuff to start melting down and then for them to come out.
Just a matter of time.
It's true. And then there's some like family stuff and some corporate shenanigans like, whoa, you sent this research in, like no one was checking in on you, but now all of a sudden like there's been some takeovers and stuff and they're like, hey, we're interested in this alien. So I'm like, oh, that's not going to be good. So it's enjoyable enough.
It's those humans that worship the perfect life form, you know, and are like intrigued by it. They're those baddie, baddie, bads.
Yeah.
Always got to have a company trying to get those alien parts, build the next weapons.
You're going to bend it to their will.